This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
It's good to have you with us today. I'm Joel Hilliker. Protests have hit every major city in America, many of them violent. The rest of the world is watching and marveling to see America tearing itself apart right now. In our first segment, we'll talk about the lamentable fact that the greatest country in the world is actually destroying itself. Bible prophecy said this would happen. In yesterday's Trumpet Brief, our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, wrote specifically about race riots being such a destructive force. He's been pointing to these prophecies virtually since the beginning of the Trumpet magazine 30 years ago. We're seeing it happen right before our eyes, and it is a self-inflicted wound, which makes it all the more tragic. In our second segment, we'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Richard Palmer about the economic effects of coronavirus in Europe and how Germany has positioned itself to be able to come out even more powerful in the wake of this crisis. Then we'll hear about a massive port that China is building in Djibouti on the Horn of Africa. As America is pulling out of that region, China is going all in. This is a military base that some have compared in size and scope to the Great Wall of China. We'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Rufaro Manyepa about this story. And I'll conclude the program today by talking about building the right emotions toward the troubles and tragedies unfolding in the world today. Did you know that Iranians held a candlelight vigil for George Floyd, the black man who died after being detained by police in Minneapolis? Did you know that a mural of Floyd has been painted on the Berlin Wall with the words, "I can't breathe"? Soccer stars in Germany displayed the message "Justice for George Floyd" after scoring goals. English Premier League leaders Liverpool took a knee at midfield. The streets around the Vancouver Art Gallery in British Columbia, Canada had to close to accommodate thousands of people protesting police brutality in America. 8,000 miles away from Minneapolis, in Auckland, New Zealand, and at least three other cities in that country, tens of thousands of people turned out to protest what one police officer did on a street in Minnesota. Cities across America are burning from protests over George Floyd's death, but there have been demonstrations and memorials around the world. Foreign Policy wrote this: "The protests in America have laid bare to the world deeply rooted societal problems in the United States, undercutting America's standing as a standard bearer of modern liberal values, including the promotion of human rights, democracy, and free market capitalism." Newspapers around the world have been covered with images of American cities filled with demonstrators, rioters, and fires. Argentina's largest newspaper headlined "Protests and Looting Throughout the U.S." Mexico's Diario 24 Horas, the lead story was "Anti-Racist Anger at the Gates of the White House." The European press have been gleefully painting America as a racist nation. Bild, Germany's most popular newspaper, had a headline, "This Killer Cop Set America Ablaze." And their article talked about the scenes like out of a civil war. Italy's La Stampa headlined "Looting, Fighting, and Curfew. The U.S. at War." The West Australian out of Perth, "USA at War with Itself." This is what America is showing to the world right now. Americans are tearing each other apart, and the world is watching and marveling. It's a grand, messy spectacle, and a lot of people see it as great entertainment, like a reality TV show of a celebrity divorce. The ones who are enjoying this the most are the authoritarian governments, those that America has criticized for lack of human rights and respect for press and protest. Suddenly, they are transforming themselves into defenders of justice. Mohammad Javad Zarif, Iran's foreign minister, tweeted this: "Some don't think hashtag Black Lives Matter. To those of us who do, it is long overdue for the entire world to wage war against racism. Time for a hashtag world against racism." Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Abbas Mousavi made a rare English language statement to the American people, saying Iran stands with them against, quote, state oppression. China has been cracking down on Hong Kong, and when a U.S. State Department spokesperson criticized the Chinese government on Twitter, a Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson retweeted the message with a three-word tweet of her own: "I can't breathe." And then the official tweeted, "All lives matter. We stand firmly with our African friends. We strongly oppose all forms of racial discrimination and inflammatory expressions of racism and hatred." This is from a nation that just in April made racist attacks against African migrants in China. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan bemoaned the racist and fascist approach of U.S. police and, quote, "the unjust order we stand against around the world." Russia's foreign ministry lamented the history of unjustified violence by U.S. police. Foreign Policy magazine wrote, "The official social media accounts of the Russian embassy in Washington condemned police violence toward members of the media after a correspondent from the Russian state-owned news agency RIA Novosti was hit with pepper spray. The embassy posted on Facebook, 'We are concerned about the increasing number of police violence cases and unjustified detentions of journalists during their coverage of protests in the United States that broke out after the murder of George Floyd.'" The post came just days after several prominent Russian reporters were detained and later released for holding one-person pickets in support of the arrested Russian journalist Ilya Azar. Azar was arrested and sentenced to 15 days imprisonment earlier last week for holding a single-person demonstration against the imprisonment of an activist who runs an online community that seeks to expose abuses of power within Russian law enforcement. So America is getting lectures from Russia, from China, from Iran about how racist and oppressive we are. Wouldn't you say there's something fishy here? There's something alarming when the protesters on the streets of America and their cheerleaders in the media and in the political class are being encouraged and egged on by foreign totalitarian states that want to see America destroyed? Those foreign nations don't care about protesters being heard. They don't care about oppression in America. They want to destroy this country, and they see an opportunity here. Well, the sad reality is a lot of people in America want the same thing. They want to bring this country down. And they're dragging a lot of foolish people along with them in their effort. At The Trumpet, we've been talking about the spiritual dimension to this attack on America. That's our latest cover story, Why the World Targets America, our July edition. You really have to understand this crucial point and see that spiritual dimension. But we also have to recognize how much we are destroying ourselves. It's not just foreign nations attacking America. This is a self-inflicted wound. And you really have a vivid picture of that playing out on America's streets. Americans fighting other Americans, looting and burning American businesses. Enemy nations don't even have to do much. They can just get out the popcorn and watch us sabotage and ruin ourselves. A lot of the unrest in America today is being supported and organized by radical leftist groups that want to destroy this country. I recently talked about the Democratic Socialists of America. They now have 66,000 members nationwide and locals in almost every state. They work closely with Antifa-aligned groups, and they've been actively supporting rioters and swelling these recent protests. They're putting out calls on social media to bring supplies to various demonstrations. They're raising money to bail out of jail those who get arrested. Branches of the Democratic Socialists in Atlanta and Seattle have been very active. DSA branches in Memphis and Los Angeles are raising funds for George Floyd uprisings nationwide. Here's a May 28th statement from the DSA National Political Committee. We, the National Political Committee of the Democratic Socialists of America, condemn the public execution of George Floyd at the hands of the Minneapolis police. His murder falls into the deeply entrenched pattern of violence, anti-blackness, and oppression upheld by policing in this country. This is white supremacy. Racist police violence is not incidental to the capitalist system. It is necessary to maintain its operation. We recognize that as we fight for a better world, it will be the police who threaten our protests, the police who will break up our picket lines, the police who selectively wield their monopoly on violence against black people and working class people to protect those with power and privilege. We stand with and share the rage of all those who are making themselves heard on the streets after years of being suffocated by policing and poverty, after years of being looted by corporations, landlords, and billionaires. Now, what's remarkable about that statement is how much of that language you're hearing from the mainstream press, from mainstream politicians. It's very radical, very revolutionary type thinking, and it has become remarkably mainstream. We'll talk more about that in a bit. But a journalist named Trevor Luden for the Epoch Times has documented similar support coming from a whole range of communist-aligned groups in America. The Workers' World Party, the WWP, is a Stalinist Trotskyist group that supports North Korea, Russia, China, Cuba, and Iran. It has chapters in about 15 cities across America, and it is really trying to support these protests in whatever way it can. The WWP's Monica Moorhead wrote an article May 28th titled, "Against Police Violence and Capitalism, to Rebel is Justified." She wrote this, "Workers' World salutes all the brave protesters in Minneapolis, currently ground zero against police terror. We also salute those activists in Los Angeles, Memphis, and other cities who are organizing protests and braving the pandemic to be in the streets or in car caravans to show solidarity with the demand justice for George Floyd and all victims of police violence." She quotes the founder of the WWP as saying, "Marxism here again cuts through it all. The Marxist view of violence distinguishes between the violence of the oppressors as against the responsive violence of the masses. Just to be able to formulate it that way is a giant step forward away from disgusting bourgeois praise for nonviolence." So they really do applaud and salute the violence that's taking place in the streets. The Maoist-leaning Revolutionary Communist Party is using the death of George Floyd to call for, quote, "a movement for an actual revolution." The Party for Socialism and Liberation, another Marxist-Leninist group that is pro-China, Iran, North Korea, Cuba, Venezuela, and Russia, they have chapters in about 30 states. They also seek to exploit the death of George Floyd, and they call this a time in history, an absolutely critical period to impose their vision of a communist revolution. They said the police will always fulfill their role of being shock troops for white supremacy and capitalism, as long as it exists in this racist state. Now, there are other communist groups like the Communist Party USA, Liberation Road, Socialist Alternative, and Socialist Unity Party. Apart from the DSA, these groups really aren't very big, but there are enough of them that with allies in groups like Black Lives Matter and Antifa, they can mobilize tens of thousands of people quite quickly. And they're very good at throwing gasoline onto situations like this to fuel the fire. And they're getting a lot of help from the mainstream press in this country and from liberal businesses and from leftist politicians who are essentially parroting their propaganda points. You have Hollywood celebrities paying bail money to get rioters out of prison. Nike released a video that said, for once, don't do it. Don't pretend there's not a problem in America. Don't turn your back on racism. Don't accept innocent lives being taken from us. Netflix tweeted, to be silent is to be complicit. Black Lives Matter. Intel announced they would donate $1 million. Verizon, $10 million to social justice organizations. YouTube donated $1 million for police reform. These are mainstream voices that are essentially cheering on the violence. And many of them have been explicitly speaking out against systemic racism and white supremacy and the genocide of blackness and the violence of whiteness, the same talking points that you read from those very radical democratic socialist organizations. They're saying that the looting and the burning and the violence is understandable, and some of them say it's right and just. By doing so, whether they realize it or not, whether it's knowingly or in ignorance, they are aligning themselves with America's worst enemies. I recently read a short book by a man named Thomas Schumann. It was written back in 1984. He was a KGB agent named Yuri Bezmenov, but he defected from the USSR. His book is called Love Letter to America, because he really did love America, and he wanted to inform us of what the communists were doing to destroy this country. He wrote this: for what other reason have thousands risked their lives, gone to unimaginable troubles, left behind their families, their motherland, and traditional ways of life to come to America? Have you ever heard of illegal aliens risking their lives crossing the border at midnight into socialist USSR? Or the boat people swimming oceans and drowning by the thousands just to reach the shores of communist China? Or defectors like me leaving behind relative affluence and risking bullets in the back in order to join the, quote, progressive workers' paradise in Russia? No, we all come here to America, obviously willing to be, quote, exploited by capitalists and enjoy, quote, oppression together with you, because we believe and know America is a better place. Sadly, that's something a lot of Americans don't believe anymore. They've come to see this as the worst nation, the most oppressive, racist country in the world. This book is basically a playbook for how to get people who live in the freest, most just, most affluent, most racially integrated country, with greater opportunity for people of all races and types and cultures, to actually come to believe the opposite. And it's done through a process of what Bezmenov calls ideological subversion, the process of changing the perception of reality in the minds of millions of peoples. Changing perception of reality, that's exactly what has been taking place, in a very effective process within the United States. Isaiah 5 verses 20 and 21 say, we are calling evil good and good evil. We're putting darkness for light and light for darkness. We're calling looters and arsonists just. And we're calling efforts to control that violence unjust. Bezmenov wrote this: the art of duping the masses into doing things to their own disadvantage and making them believe it is, quote, the will of people, is as ancient as mankind itself. The essence of subversion is best expressed in the famous Marxist slogan: if you substitute proletarians for a more appropriate word, useful idiots of the world, unite. To achieve the desired effect, the subverter must first make idiots out of normal people and divide them. And he goes through a whole list of tactics, including divide the people into hostile groups by constantly harping on controversial issues of no importance, destroy people's faith in their national leaders by holding the latter up for contempt, ridicule, and disgrace, always preach democracy but seize power as fast and as ruthlessly as possible, encourage civil disorders and foster a lenient and soft attitude on the part of the government towards such disorders. He says the main principle of ideological subversion is turning a stronger force against itself. Just like in the Japanese martial arts, you do not stop the blow of a heavier, more powerful enemy with an equally forceful blow. You may simply hurt your hand. Instead, you catch the striking fist with your hand and pull the enemy in the direction of his own blow until he crashes into a wall or any other heavy object in his way. That's really exactly what is happening in America today. We are having our own force used against us. Bezmenov says, the situation is similar to a house, the owners of which have stored explosives and inflammable materials inside. To destroy this house, the enemy does not have to intrude physically into it. It's enough to start a fire next door and wait till the wind blows in the right direction. Meanwhile, the enemy may throw in some great ideas for the owners to argue about in order to take their attention off the actual fire. Environmental protection, gay liberation, or emancipation of house pets are the types of non-critical arguments that divert America's attention from the real danger. Smart people would notice the fire and remove the inflammable objects and material before the house catches the fire. Useful idiots will keep arguing about whether it is constitutional or not to pay firefighters, or the equality of husband and wife in domestic chores. Who should remove the combustibles until the actual explosion blows their enfeebled brains all over the neighborhood? He makes a lot of other points about discrediting law enforcement, about buying people off with socialist programs that make them loyal to the welfare state, but not the nation. There's a lot of information in this book that is quite chilling to read. He says, in the area of social life, by encouraging you to put your individual rights over your obligations, the subverter achieves the desired effect. A society composed of irresponsible individuals, each one doing his own thing and acting according to the law of the jungle, such subversion of society is the first step to tyranny. It's chilling reading, especially when you see how the U.S. is tearing itself apart right now. And this is from 1984, and he even talks about racial and ethnic interrelations is one of the most vulnerable areas for demoralization. I'd encourage you to read this little book. It's about 55 pages. We'll link to it in the show notes for the program today. But it shows the danger in not knowing our history. It shows the danger when we eliminate religion and morality, the danger in not believing in the ideals that founded this nation, not instilling loyalty in our people, the danger in turning our education system over to liberals and giving ourselves over to socialist thinking. America's enemies may have gotten the ball rolling, and you can be sure they're cheering now as that picks up momentum, but we are doing this to ourselves. We are destroying ourselves. America's streets are burning, and there are actually Americans saying this is a good thing. That is calling good evil and evil good. They say this needs to happen for the country to get healthy. There's nothing healthy about what is happening right now. This is a sign of terrible sickness, terminal sickness. As Isaiah said in Isaiah chapter 1, you will revolt more and more. The whole head is sick and the whole heart faint. From the sole of the foot even to the head, there is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. Your country is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Your land, strangers devoured in your presence, and it is desolate. The more these nihilistic tendencies are encouraged, the weaker America becomes, and the easier prey for the nation's enemies. Civilizations do die. People today tend to be pretty ignorant of history, but great civilizations don't just pass on gracefully and join the community of nations, they tend to die pretty violent deaths. And we are witnessing the death of a great nation. Now, in the prophecies of the Bible, God explains why this is happening. And he explains how he is going to correct the situation. These problems cannot be solved by man. You're not going to hear any solutions from any politician or media personality or celebrity or CEO or protester or anyone else. The way of peace they know not. But God is going to allow us to reach the point of desperation where we will finally acknowledge that fact. Finally acknowledge the fact that we don't have the solutions. And at that point, he will intervene to solve these problems.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Coronavirus has been causing tremendous economic devastation to countries around the world, but one country has positioned itself to actually benefit economically relative to its neighbors, as we will now hear in this report from Richard Palmer.
Coronavirus and the response of governments to it has caused economic carnage across the world. But Germany prepared for the storm ahead of time, and it is coping much better than most. It's using that advantage to cement its dominance of Europe. Germany has spent the last few years getting rid of its debt. Now, to get a picture of how indebted a country is, it's useful to compare the size of a country's debt to the size of its economy, its GDP. So at the end of last year, for example, America's debt-to-GDP ratio was 107%. That means if the entire economic output of the United States was devoted to paying off that debt, then it would take America just over a year to pay all of its debt off. Much of Europe is in a similar position. Here's some figures for a few countries. So for Greece, that figure is 177%. For Italy, 135%, France, 98%, Spain, 96%, the UK, 81%. Now, all of those figures are from the end of last year, before the coronavirus hits. Anything above 90% is generally considered the danger zone, where high debt starts slowing down the economy. But among all of the world's major economies, one stands out for its prudence and its low debt, Germany. Their debt-to-GDP ratio is at 60%. Now, that's less than half of Italy's. And instead of borrowing more money each year to make ends meet, Germany has been consistently paying back this debt. And the result puts Germany in a strong position. Across Europe, businesses are failing. Germany can afford to bail out its firms, though, while others can't. And so as companies go bust around the world, German businesses stand ready to snap up assets at bargain basement prices. Now, within the EU, any time the government makes a major bailout, that has to be approved by the European Commission. Around half of all state aid approved by the Commission since coronavirus hit has gone to German companies. Tobias Kaiser at Deutsche Welle wrote that no country in Europe is in a better position than Germany when it comes to funding domestic economic recovery. He wrote that, but in Brussels, Rome and Madrid, politicians see that as a potential problem. They're worried that less economically stable countries might be left behind by the corona pandemic and that Germany and other countries with strong economies will widen the gap between themselves and the rest of the EU. Now, there are other countries like Poland and the Netherlands that have low levels of debt, and they also seem set to weather the storm well. But Germany is by far the largest economy in Europe. That makes them the big worry here. Now, typically, this level of state aid, this level of bailout that Germany's engaging in would be against EU law. But that's a law that Germany's never been particularly keen on. They've been censured 67 times for breaking EU state aid law. And by comparison, the UK has only been censured 4 times. Now, you can't really blame Germany for using good economic times to prepare for the bad. That's what every country, including the United States and Britain, should have been doing. But many have pointed out that Germany is a stickler for other countries sticking to Europe's economic rules. And yet, when it suited Germany, these state aid rules were quickly thrown out of the window. The Telegraph's Ambrose Evan Pritchard, for example, describes how Germany's massive bailouts mean that their companies will be able to pick through the corporate ruins of the South, acquire productive plant on the cheap, and entrench northern dominance of the EMU system. It repeats the austerity episode. Who bought up Greece's airports when the Troika forced Athens to sell off state assets for a pittance? Just guess. And of course, if you guessed Germany, you're correct. At the same paper, Jeremy Warner contrasted Germany's loose approach to state aid rules to the way that its judges have blocked the European Central Bank from offering significant help to more indebted countries. Well, he wrote, as it is, and with treaties on state aid suspended, Germany has been throwing its money at its economy on an almost unimaginable scale. Its judges seem to want to starve others of the ability to do the same. Far from being a benign economic hegemon at the heart of Europe, Germany finds itself accused of returning to its bad old imperialist ways. Now, there are still some dark clouds for Germany's economy. Their reliance on exports means that economic troubles in China or America will very quickly become economic troubles in Germany. But their current strength and this low level of debt is cementing their dominance of Europe. The 2008 financial crisis clearly revealed Germany was the leader of Europe. You know, that crisis led to Greece and Cyprus becoming virtual German colonies. Could the fallout from coronavirus take Germany to an even higher level of power within the EU? That certainly looks like the way we're heading at the moment. In August 1950, Herbert W. Armstrong predicted that the world will be stunned, dumbfounded, to see Germany emerge suddenly in a power never equaled by Hitler, by a union of 10 nations in Europe, probably including some at present puppets of Russia, in a gigantic United States of Europe. Soon, the United States of Europe will emerge, with Germany at its head. While these puppets of Russia are now part of the EU. That United States of Europe maybe is not quite here yet, but Germany is clearly the head. And more recently in his booklet, Germany's Conquest of the Balkans, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flory wrote, "It will not be long before Europe is reunited as the Holy Roman Empire. It will be led very assertively by Germany." We're already basically at that reality. That book was first published in 1999, and it's full of statements that would have seemed controversial at the time, but are now, you know, pretty regularly in your newspapers. You saw, we read from the Telegraph, with Jeremy Warner warning that Germany's back to its bad old imperialist ways. Mr. Flory wrote in that book that the historical plan of the European Union was to control a dangerous Germany, but it's clear that Germany is controlling the EU. He wrote that it is now the politics of Germany that powerfully influence politics in all Europe. Now, that may have seemed controversial at the time, not now. As the economic crisis got underway all the way back in 2008, Mr. Flory wrote, "However it happens, Germany is prophesied to come out on top of the financial crisis." And he warned that it would lead to a union led ultimately not from Brussels, but from Berlin. And we saw Germany's power grow clearer and stronger over Europe during that 2008 crisis and in the years following. And we're seeing that again now with the corona crisis. Germany's position just keeps getting stronger and stronger. Now, these men made their forecasts based on Bible prophecy. That may seem like an unusual way to analyze the news, but it's hard to deny its accuracy looking at some of those already fulfilled prophecies that we've mentioned. The Bible forecasts a power dominated by Germany, made up of a union of 10 nations in Europe. And that's the direction that Europe is already clearly heading in. Now, you can learn more about where Europe is heading and what the Bible says about it from Mr. Flory's article in the May-June Trumpet print edition titled Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire.
Thank you very much for that, Richard. You know, you mentioned the 2008 economic crisis and how Germany used that to effectively take over Greece and Cyprus. And that really seems like a perfect example, very recent historical example of how Germany could come out of this crisis even stronger. Would you mind just giving us a little more detail about what Germany did there and how we could see that same scenario play out again?
Greece and Cyprus reached the situation where they weren't really able to borrow money to keep their governments afloat. And so they needed money from the European Union. Germany is the largest economy in the European Union, was therefore going to have to be putting up the lion's share of that cash. So what happened is when these countries turned to Europe, Germany wasn't just going to hand over that cash willy-nilly. They pointed out, well, look, you've just got yourselves into trouble by spending too much money. We're not going to loan you money unless there are conditions dictating how you spend that. And this played out over quite a number of years, but eventually got to the point where you had European officials, very often whom the most senior were Germans, or if we're not Germans, we're at least in the, coming from this German-dominated structure, going into Greece, going into Italy, telling the elected governments of these countries, you've got to sell that country, company, telling Greece, well, you've got to sell your airports, and you've got to sell this, and you've got to sell that. And because this was in the middle of a recession, it was often, they were often being sold off at bargain basement prices. They were telling them, you need to raise your pension age, you need to change your tax structures, you need to change how you pay civil servants. And in a lot of cases, some of the things they were telling them to do were pretty prudent reforms. But the point is how you tax, how you raise money and how you spend money are some of the central things to sovereignty of a nation.
Yeah.
No taxation without representation is the famous slogan from the American referendum. And people have fought for centuries about the right to control how their money is being spent. And the fallout of this crisis saw Germany controlling or having the right to control how this money was spent. And even as countries like Greece exit formally the bailout program, it's still in such a way that until they have paid back all of that EU debt, which is not going to happen, I think, for potentially 30 years or more, the European Union basically has veto power on a lot of these spending projects. And again, that effectively means Germany, and on how their money is spent. This power was so strong that even when Greece held a referendum and said, no, we want to go in this completely different direction, it didn't matter. That government that called the referendum ended up collapsing, and Greece ended up accepting the bailout and the conditions that went with it that the referendum rejected. And basically, that hold that Germany had over Greece was more powerful than Greek democracy.
And one could presumably see this playing out in more and larger European nations that are in the same kinds of economic problems that Greece and Cyprus were in before. What I find interesting is you go back and you look at that history, when that occurred, there was a lot of protest within Greece and people, holding up placards with pictures of Angela Merkel with a Hitler mustache and hearkening back to Germany's Nazi past. And yet, in the end, it really didn't have a whole lot of choice but to go along with it. And most of that protest has kind of died down. You were mentioning in your report about these examples of Germany insisting on holding other European nations to rules that it is unwilling to follow. And it's ringing a lot of alarm bells for other nations, especially given Germany's past. But in the end, there's not really much they can do to stop it. And it seems Germany is very well aware of that.
Maybe. I there's a lot, I think, of uncertainties this time around and factors that could mean things play out potentially very differently. Yes, Italy is mad with Germany right now. And you've got even a majority now, potentially, for Italy leaving the Eurozone. Leaving even the European Union. there's a lot of people in Italy that are looking, that are saying Germany is trying to, is using coronavirus to try and do a Greece to us. And the idea of Germany using a virus and a disaster that has kind of hit all of Europe to take advantage of Italy is something that's abhorrent to a lot of people. Now, Germany's fairness, I think that's, you know, they're more concerned with trying to make sure their tax money doesn't go to waste. But still, it's led to a lot of anger. But Italy is not Greece. Italy is, you know, one of the G7 economies. It's a huge. A Greece level crisis is something that could pretend, or an Italy doing a Greece could blow up the European Union. And in some ways, I think that gives Italy more leverage. So Germany getting control of Greece that way is one potential way that this could play out. Maybe you could have it play out, for example, with the Pope stepping in and brokering something that's much more lenient on Greece than some sort of halfway deal that then starts to bring the Catholic Church more into control of Europe. Maybe you see the whole Eurozone kind of project almost all fall apart and some new structure has to be quickly built out of the ashes. I think there's a, I think it's very hard to see the specifics of how this plays out this time around.
Well, given the deep structural problems that are being exposed by this crisis, you can definitely see that the entire economic structure of the European Union is in for some dramatic changes. And when you look at the prophecies that show just how strong Germany in particular, but Europe even as a whole, will become economically in the time ahead, you know that things are going to be changing very rapidly and significantly. We thank you very much for that, Richard. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about Germany positioning itself to actually improve economically, or to take advantage of the situation that is taking place with coronavirus in Europe. He's written a trumpet brief about this. It should have hit your email inboxes today and go out up on the website later on. We thank you very much for your time, Richard.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
China is making aggressive inroads into nations across the world, some would say in imperialist, even neocolonialist fashion. One notable example is taking place in the strategic Horn of Africa, as we will now hear in this report from Rufaro Manyepa.
China has completed a massive extension on its military base in Djibouti. It is now so big that it is China's first permanent overseas military port able to accommodate aircraft carriers. And with its strategic location on the mouth of the Red Sea, China can now have an even more sizable presence along one of the world's busiest shipping routes. The majority of the work was on a massive 1,100-foot pier, which was completed late last year. Its construction is what now allows China to accommodate aircraft carriers, large warships, and nuclear-powered attack submarines. Another impressive aspect of this new construction is not its capacity for aircraft carriers and warships, but the magnitude of the base itself. The Asia Times even compared it to the Great Wall of China because of its sheer size. The base doesn't just look imposing, it has been designed to be highly defendable on a scale rarely seen in war zones. While China has never had any of its overseas bases attacked by insurgents, this new base's defensive construction shows that it learned the lesson from Western forces being attacked in Afghanistan and Iraq. An invader approaching via road would have to pass through an automated gate, take sharp turns ideal for slowing down vehicles, pass two vehicle checkpoints, and pop up vehicle barriers, all before reaching large concrete doors. Trying to avoid the road would see one confronted by multiple fences with razor wire before approaching wireframe barriers filled with gigantic sandbags. For perspective, Western forces in Afghanistan use these barriers as the main fortifications. Here, they are just the outer wall. Inside the barrier is the main concrete wall, complete with crenellations, gun loops, and tall towers. Every side of the base is thoroughly built, with significant security fences and guard forces, stationed marines, infantry vehicles, anti-tank missiles, and automatic cannons. Many countries have bases in Djibouti, but none so strategically located or as heavily fortified. Even America's base at Camp Lemonnier pales in comparison to China's. This massive base was China's first overseas, but it appears it will not be the last. China is intent on developing more strategic facilities, allowing it to base parts of its navy in key parts in the world. This Djibouti base at the mouth of the Red Sea is opposite another heavily financed Beijing base at the port of Gwadar in western Pakistan, leased in 2015 for at least 43 years. China is interested in constructing another naval base in South America. Through the coronavirus pandemic, China has been tightening its grip in the Pacific and securing its dominance over competing Asian powers in the South China Sea. This Djibouti base on the other side of the world is a similar statement of intent, not only to dominate Asia, but the world. China's total takeover of Djibouti directly jeopardizes the US's Camp Lemonnier base and its 4,000 troops. US General Thomas Waldhauser expressed his concern over this because the port of Dorale, directly adjacent to China's new completed base, provides the US with services for most of its military operations in Africa. If the Chinese took over that port, the consequences could be significant, General Waldhauser said. Moreover, our US Navy ships come in and out of there to refuel and whatnot. There could be some consequences. That is why it is important to watch this, he said. The recently completed expansions effectively give China control over a port where American ships refuel, restock, and resupply the base. And China is still expanding the port. America has done nothing to stop it. Beyond jeopardizing America's base in Djibouti, China is pushing the US out of world trade as prophesied in the Bible. Jesus Christ himself prophesied of a period of war and conflict called the times of the Gentiles. In the United States and Britain in prophecy, Herbert W. Armstrong proved that Bible prophecy regarding Israel refers mainly to the nations of Great Britain and the United States of America. Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, explains that the term Gentiles refers to non-Israelite nations. Once you understand who Israel is, then you can see how the Gentiles, these non-Israelite peoples, have started to take charge of the world already. Indeed, we do see China, one of these Gentile nations, starting to take charge today, not only of Asia Pacific, but of the whole world. In our free booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, we write, quote, "Critics groused about China's poor human rights, its authoritarianism, its support for corrupt regime, its pollution. Correct as they are, their criticism simply isn't going to stop this bullet train. This country is barreling into the future and in the process, changing the world." End quote. Even today, China has lied about coronavirus, blamed it on America, hoarded medical supplies, and subsequently used mask diplomacy. And yet, even with all that, it continues barreling into the future and increasing its naval power all over the world while the world simply watches. Keep your eye on China. Within a few short years, this nation, the ascendant, proud China that has emerged today, will dazzle the world. Watching its vault into great power status truly is a look at the future.
Thank you very much, Rufaro. You know, we've been talking quite a bit about China in the middle of all of this coronavirus. And of course, we were talking last week and the week before about what China has been doing with Hong Kong and just how bold and aggressive it's getting in many ways. What we're seeing here, this isn't something that's just come up in the last month. This is years long work that is finally reaching completion. And it just shows just how direct and how unabashed China is about exhibiting this kind of power and authority.
Yes, sir. China is no longer really being questioned on all these aggressive actions it's taking. And like you said, Hong Kong is the prime example of this. I mean, last week we saw the new imposition of the anti-sedition legislation that they brought up over there, and it's going to allow China to station secret police in Hong Kong, set up national security institutions, really compromise so much of Hong Kong's territory, free speech, markets, education, all those things. It's really fascinating to see just how little pushback there has been on this front. And China can see that, and they're able to really just go on boldly. That's what they're doing here in Djibouti. You know, they do what they want. They're building these bases, and they're really expanding their power in Djibouti and Hong Kong and Taiwan, all over the place. And a lot of the countries, the powers around the world, are now just letting them do it. And China recognizes that, and they're going to press even more to keep increasing their power. And it's really important to watch just how that is going to be developing and how they're going to do this even more to make sure that they gain even more power and influence.
Well, it is quite a contrast when you see what China is doing in building this base in Djibouti at the same time that the United States, you mentioned Camp Le Monnier, but the United States is really trying to decrease its presence throughout the Middle East and Northern Africa. What a contrast between these two powers, one on the descent and the other definitely rising. Well, we do appreciate that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Rufaro Manyepa about China's infrastructure development in Djibouti on the Horn of Africa. He's written an article, China Builds Modern-Day Great Wall of China in East Africa. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much, Rufaro.
Always a pleasure, sir.
It's time for today's last word.
Suffering and evil are all around us. If you watch the news, you're confronted with it constantly. It can be easy to be numb or casual toward it all, but that's a mistake. God is deeply emotional, grieved, and angry at the sins of mankind. And God is clear, we must cultivate these godly emotions. Ezekiel 9 and verse 4 says, "Go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and that cry for all the abominations that be done in the midst thereof." So God marks those who sigh and cry over Israel's abominations. Why would he do that, and what is that for? As our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, brings out in his booklet, Ezekiel, the End-Time Prophet, the words sigh and cry are intense. Sigh describes animals groaning from famine in the book of Joel and people starving in Lamentations. Proverbs 29, verse 2 translates it as mourn. God mourns over Israel's sins. Cry describes the cries of the wounded in Jeremiah 51 and Ezekiel 26. Mr. Flurry wrote, "These are the kinds of strong emotions in God's people who sigh and cry because of the abominations committed in God's church, first of all, and secondarily in the nations of Israel. Only those people who sigh and cry receive a mark and are delivered to a place of safety. God's people must be moved deeply about the sins of spiritual and physical Israel." Now, we must be moved by the sins within spiritual Israel. Ministers have betrayed the shepherd. Members have abandoned their father. God's people are dying spiritually. We also must be deeply disturbed by the sins of physical Israel: blasphemy, idolatry, materialism, injustice, fornication, deceit that destroys families and lives and invites God's curses. God mourns these things. He loathes sin because he loathes the suffering it causes sinners. He abhors these people's sins because he loves these people, and sin is destroying them. God's servants have felt this godly emotion. Lot, it says in 2 Peter 2, was greatly distressed by the licentiousness or the unbridled lust and shamelessness around him. He was vexed or tormented in his righteous soul day after day with their lawless deeds. Jeremiah wrote, "Horror has taken hold upon me because of the wicked that forsake your law. Rivers of waters run down my eyes because they keep not your law." He also wrote, "But if you will not hear it, my soul shall weep in secret places for your pride, and my eyes shall weep sore and run down with tears because the Eternal's flock is carried away captive." The Apostle Paul wrote, "I shall bewail many which have sinned already and have not repented of the uncleanness and fornication and lasciviousness which they have committed." How about you? Hopefully you hate sin in your own life, not only because of what it does to you, but because of what it did to Jesus Christ. But how do you feel about the sin in this world? What sin is doing to your neighbors and your countrymen and to the rest of the world? Think about this. Pray that you will react to people's sins the way that God does. See people as God does for what they are. They are family and future family held captive by the devil. Realize the horrors they're about to experience that are prophesied in Scripture, demonic barbarity and violence on an unprecedented scale. Have enough love for them to mourn as God does and to do what we can to save them. When Jesus Christ encountered sinners, he was moved with compassion. He saw them for what they are: lost, shepherdless sheep, vulnerable to satanic wolves. And it provoked him to do God's work. You can read that in Matthew 9, verses 35 through 38. In Luke 19, it says that as he entered Jerusalem his last time, he beheld the city and wept over it, thinking of all those precious people. His mind was filled with a vision of the horrifying fate they would suffer. And he then prophesied of Jerusalem's destruction, a prophecy that was rapidly fulfilled in AD 70. He was about to be torturously murdered, and yet he was emotional about the murder and the mayhem that would befall the city and the people he loved. That is the love of God. If we don't think about this deeply enough, then we simply won't have proper motivation to do God's work. If you saw a tornado approaching a home and you had an opportunity to warn the people who were heedlessly going about their business, you would be urgent to try to keep them from harm. Well, a tribulation scale tornado is descending on this world. In Ezekiel's vision, in Ezekiel 9, God sends a destruction through Israel so deadly that the prophet was shocked. Mr. Fleury wrote, "Ezekiel thought God was going to kill all Israel. Before this is over in the end time, many in the U.S. and Britain will think the same thing. No punishment will have ever been so devastating." But God explained to Ezekiel the appalling perversity these people were committing and how important it was that it be punished. Sin ultimately results in eternal death, and God is doing everything he can to prevent that. Most of these people will be resurrected, but those who come to truly know God and still choose sin lose their lives eternally. This is happening right now to many who have been in God's own church. How tragic to be offered eternal life in God's family and to choose sin instead. God notices those who take on his perspective, his emotions toward the abominations proliferating all around us. Ezekiel says he sets a mark on them, which means he'll protect them from the cataclysm these abominations will produce. Most importantly, God knows that those who sigh and cry against sin are becoming what he himself is, love. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Richard Palmer and Rufaro Manyepa. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Tacitus. It is of eloquence as of a flame. It requires matter to feed it and motion to excite it, and it brightens as it burns. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.